In Chicago, there's a really fascinating movement of community organization. It's called the Contract Buyers League. After the war, in about 1948, there was a case that voided the restrictive covenant, that is, the promise that stayed with the land that prevented an owner or his successor from selling land to anyone who was black, because there was a promise in the deed that could not be erased not to do so. That opened up some very limited mobility, plus the economic changes after the war. And old areas were vacated by people who could do better, and blacks moved into the west side. Later, when there was a second operation of new housing available to blacks, after the market essentially had been satisfied in the city, new housing was made available, both on terms of contract, that is, where property was sold as you buy a car, with none of the protections of a mortgage. If you missed a payment or two, you could be forfeit and have your land taken from you and lose the investment that you had made, with no more rights than a tenant in a slum. The situation was compounded by the fact that the FHA, the federal government, had a written, enforced policy not to guarantee mortgages, in changing neighborhoods. Well, the only places that blacks could move and buy housing was in changing neighborhoods, because they didn't own any housing to speak of. And so that effectively created a false market. They could not get traditional financing. Plus, you had the pressure of a limited housing market and the contract device. Contract device is said to be risky. And instead of changing the price, the interest on the contract, the price was changed. So that there are hundreds of cases that have come up where a buyer at $10,000 in one day would sell to a black at $20,000 the next. Some people who owned the houses sold on those terms, or relatively near those, on the west side of Chicago. In the second wave of the new housing on the south side, the new housing was sold on contract for 10 to 20% higher because there were no mortgages. Now, that was under a federal policy, the black tax. Now, the suit that was brought and that is pending and brought by a very fine law firm called Jenner & Block, and they're an interesting operation. They're representing Jeremiah Stamler and his attack on what was called HUAC, and some very, very unique litigation, and they had the Witherspoon murder case and all kinds of things. They and a black lawyer named Ming, who once was a law teacher at Chicago, they together with a large group of volunteer lawyers brought a federal civil rights suit and even worked on the slavery amendment and created a class of black buyers, the class created by the economic and formal conditions I'd mentioned to you, and brought a class action against the west side and against the south side sellers, and that's pending in the federal district court. And that by itself is really a fascinating way of changing and using ideas, regrouping existing ideas for new remedies. And they want to reform the contracts to a fair price. The clients are militant and impatient with the court system and have decided to withhold their payments. When you hit withhold payments, there are lots of awful things that happen. And whether counseled or not, people apparently didn't care and have withheld twice. The current withholding is added up. Some recent projections will affect the sellers perhaps in the amount of $5 million. I don't think it's quite up to that. With that tension, we got into that case as kind of interlopers. We'd done a lot of work for some of the individual people. And anticipated, and are very presumptuous, I must say, in anticipating the kinds of problems that might come up. Because when the buyers withheld their money, it was clear that the sellers were going to go into the state court under this landlord-tenant arrangement and the statute called the Forcible Entry and Detainer Act. Howard Ziff and I were talking earlier tonight. That was an improvement in Blackstone's time. It hasn't continued to improve, I'll tell you. Under that statute, the sellers would go in and allege non-payment and get the houses back. And that was predictable, and it happened. We got into a fantastic hassle with the lawyers in the case, trying to urge them to raise a question attacking that statute, saying that that was an integral part of their case. We believe that the statute, because it does not conform to other kinds of court practices and distorts relationships between contracting parties, violated both the due process and equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment. We found on some research that the statute had never been attacked head-on in any place. It's a common statute. It's been nicked at from time to time and place to place. We got into arguments with 30 lawyers at a time from large firms who wanted to honor the sanctity of the existing statute and wanted to urge the contract buyers to pay. The judge had set a payment order slightly below the contracts. They wanted them to pay and at the end of the case have whatever money due them repaid when things were sorted out. The case is very complex. It may take about 3 years because of all of the discovery and other problems that there are. And the people refused to wait. It was our argument that within the limits of the responsibilities of a lawyer and turning that around, isn't there a responsibility to try and figure out some remedy for this kind of problem? We insisted that the statute be attacked. Well, the fascinating part is we prepared the attack and the lawyers have taken to it and we're kind of slipping out and becoming anonymous in the case. We did the opening brief and the judges and Judge Will in Chicago is to decide whether or not a three-judge court will be convened, which is the civil rights mechanism of the day where you can attack a state statute that violates the federal constitution. And he will decide soon whether or not to convene the three-judge court. If that case is won, in the short run, it will realign the relationship of these parties in this litigation and change their whole negotiating scheme. It will have a very, very drastic effect on the landlord or the sellers, because if the buyers are allowed to hold out and defend in these landlord-tenant cases in the state court by saying that our price was too high, something not permitted under the present forcible entry and detainer statute, it will grind to a halt the efforts by the sellers to get at them in any way. And it will attack problems of excessive bond, shortened time periods to appeal, lack of notice, denial of a hearing, and other things like that. The effect of which recently, that statute recently was shown by the Daily News, that to be that so many people just gave up that in Chicago eviction cases are ticked off every 20 seconds. There's some that are contested, but mostly the contesting is a lot of screaming until the person gives up because there are no defenses. So it will have, if it wins, and it's a big if, a great, great big if, but if it wins, it will have a great effect. But the greater effect, beyond the interest of these couple of thousand people, and beyond all dreams of theirs, it could create tenant unions in the United States. The present times are where tenant unions are made up of people who get angry and withhold their rent. They all find that they have to give up if it's rent withholding, because the landlord eventually gets smart and goes in under this statute. If the statute is destroyed and parties are allowed to litigate like they are on contracts, where both sides get an even kind of operational forum. If they can say, if a tenant can say, I didn't pay my rent because I got no heat, or a contract buyer can say, I didn't pay because I've learned now that I was overcharged, and judge, I'll pay after you find whether or not I owe it, it will change the relationship of landlords and tenants. Now, it may not be that this case will prevail at the moment, but it will start, I think, the kind of ball rolling where it will splinter off and the issues will be raised over and over and over again, long overdue, and something, someplace, will come out of it. Along the way in this kind of problem, there are the insights that you gain by messing around with these problems. When the Bar Association picked up the Daily News quote expose of the 22nd routine, the answer of the president of the Bar Association was that the public didn't understand the system. These were people, the president said, who were in default. They hadn't answered and they were out, so that it was just an automatic thing. But they were in that position because of an oppressive law. And once that's made clear, shouldn't a Bar Association take on the obligation of analyzing that law and joining in some kind of suggestion to revise it? And that's the challenge to all kinds of institutions involved or affected. I'll try to talk between the rhythms that we're that are visiting upon us. Now, the difficulties with this client, and it's not our client, we're only in it sometimes, is a mass of people with different amounts of information, all of whom don't appear at the same time, many of whom were permitted to speak before the judge, and that's a very strange thing to happen in court. They really talked about different problems than the ones that are being treated, and the kinds of tensions and chaos and confusion, and the role of a lawyer who really has to be an explainer in order to be an advocate is a very tricky one. You find that you have to say, well, you can't do this because, and you don't get any further, really. There's no faith in what you say. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense to go back to the practices someplace in England where this was an improvement and to say that this statute has never been revised and it's in its basic form since 1874, and you ought to like it. Now, the coalition is a different subject, if I can change on that. Do you think I should get some water? I somehow lost my... The coalition is really a fascinating operation. It's made up of, from day to day, of the names and numbers are different, but of a variety of a variety of kinds of organizations. Some are sophisticated, like Breadbasket. TWO, the Woodlawn organization, doesn't really participate much. They're very sophisticated. Down the street gangs. And leadership or representative of those people get together and suffer from an excess of democracy in debates that go on and on and on, where the people end up talking to themselves and listening to themselves and often are away from the issues that they're dealing with. And I tell you that openly and frankly, because of the frustrations, perhaps, the lack of information, and a total unwillingness to not take a stronger position than the guy on the left and the guy on the right of the people that you're sitting with in the room. And I think that the expression of C.T. Vivian that you may have read about yesterday about a curfew in Chicago was a product, probably, of that same kind of frustration. Now, I've dealt with the spokesman for the coalition, Vivian, Meredith Gilbert, a fascinating guy from the west side of Chicago. Sometimes Jesse Jackson is there. Reverend Burrell is a very complex man. The other side of the table liked very much to know that he's there because he has a criminal record and they're all moralists. And sometimes Dave Reed, who worked for Governor Ogilvie for a while, finds a strange role of re-entering his community. They speak and accept notes from their constituency who are not allowed to speak under an agreement in meetings with Mayor Daley that go on and it's absolutely fascinating to watch the mayor, who is really as good as anyone can be at this sort of thing. I mean, I can see him in one day in an ad I'll tell you about where we attacked him in the suit where we reversed the case around his house that Dick Gregory was in, and then the next day with his absolutely elegant skill of negotiating something that's so complex and works on so many levels, and much of which is very remote from him. And I find it sometimes not very clearly accepted by people if I mention that he's a very skillful man in this circumstance. And once he sees a certain kind of message, that these people are a constituency, do have a representative political foothold, He changes. It's a different mass, and he plays a different role. The coalition, excuse me, worked its way up first by storming building sites in the city and closing down $100 million worth of construction in a very, very clever operation. They went in black communities where there were some black construction workers who went off the job immediately. The whites suffering isolation for the first time in their lives left too, not in sympathy, not necessarily in direct fear, but out of something that's hard to describe, and they took off. And pretty soon the projects were closed down, and the police joined in them. And thank you very much. Sorry to interrupt. No, that's just... No, that's fine. Sorry, I seem to have a frog. The police often preceded these guys to the building sites and asked the directors to close, the whoever was in charge, to close them down. The builders, not the unions, the builders finally brought an injunction proceeding and got an injunction against any further demonstrations like this of all kinds, even in anticipated sites. And then when Abernathy said he was coming to the city, the injunction was widened to include anyone who was in sympathy with the group, a rather extraordinary and novel kind. And we don't know what was in the judge's mind because he's now died. I don't know what he was thinking. But he was very glad to sign that, I'll tell you that, and very anxious to do so. And didn't question things very much. And it's like the old labor injunctions. It really is, where the impetus is taken out of a movement. But the effort brought the parties together in the mayor's office. And now what's happening is really, after the evolution of, that resulted from the kinds of strange things that I've mentioned, some traditional things are happening. And they're down to two versions. You sign mine. No, you sign mine. And it's hard to tell what the differences are. But they've all become matters of principle. Now we'll see whether the mayor can pull it off. They should be down to one more meeting where they can tell. They've had, I think, 9 now, where it was very interesting to see builders and unions who never had really met black people before. And it's a very interesting thing. There's a guy named McLaughlin from the AFL-CIO who's the only black on that side of the table. I'm the only white on this side of the table. And that's very confusing to the other white people. The mayor talked to me, asked me once whether he'd come at it the right way. I don't know, but he assumed that that I was the one to talk to because of his own, limited world where he talks only to a certain limited number of friends and only a limited number of black people. The fascinating part has been to watch the arguments and the debates over what happens to be a matter of principle again, some kind of style, sometimes what's insulting, but to see it kept up and the pressure kept up. But what's underlying it all is the tragic commentary, I'm sure, on all the kinds of things that we face in the urban scene. The whites are not willing to move over. The blacks have come down to saying that they will accept 4,000 new positions. The whites say the economy won't sustain 4,000 more jobs. Well, it's quite simple. They don't have to have 4,000 new jobs. Instead of admitting new white people into the union programs, why don't they stop for a while and share? That will never occur to one of the union or one of the builders. And it won't occur to the builders because they have no minds in this negotiation. They are dominated in every instance, in every breath, by the unions. Chicago is a sweetheart town. There hasn't been a construction strike in 26 years. And whatever the unions want, they get. And that's just how it goes. And it's fascinating to see all the money sitting there told by all the labor just what to do and what to say. Now, one of the arguments made on why these negotiations should never be and nothing should come off of them was because the coalition was made up of street gangs. And that just came out and out and out. Well, there's a very interesting week. I think it was October. I get mixed up with so many things going on. But first, there was Black Monday, which came up just after the builders tried to hold the coalition leaders in contempt for violating the injunction. And they went out to the Civic Square and were the first people, it's like discovering a new land, they were the first people to climb on the Picasso statue in the Civic Square and to give speeches from there. And it was the first time that the police stayed out. It was sort of the lesson of the convention. The police were really good. They rimmed the place, stayed out, they kept whites who would have caused trouble away quietly. You'd see a policeman put an arm around a guy and say something to him. Our office looks right down on it. We've got the best view in the city. And you just see them quiet it down. And debates went on from after that group broke up until 6 at night, and the police never did anything but slide through if there was some excessive tension. And it was fascinating to see what they can do. The next thing that happened, I think it was the same week, but it was the time anyhow when the federal government sought to have hearings. And first on Wednesday, the union stormed the LaSalle Hotel and closed down the hearings before they were open. They stomped, beat chairs, screamed, shouted, swore, no arrests. The hearings were continued to the next morning at the Customs House in a nowhere place near the big post office in Chicago. There were thousands of construction men, most of them from the union of the main negotiator in this whole negotiation, the electrical workers and steel iron workers, the guys who climb things. The hard hats were every place. The police were terrified and would not open a way for witnesses. I got into a very odd circumstance there that took away the youth gang issue in the cases that I was telling, the instances that I was telling you about. I went with my associate Cecil Butler, who's black, to go in to represent our clients who were going to testify. We passed a tavern where at 9:30 or 10 in the morning, where there were 50 or 100 completely stone-drunk construction workers falling into the street, made our way past them, they were sort of docile, and into the group past the police and began to walk. Someone up at the top of the stairs started to point at us, and the group just went like liquid, following us everywhere, and a wall started. And we tried to shove our ways through. And we pushed, and they pushed, and there were more of them. There were many instances where hard hats, a guy would really come with his fist and just be ready, and four men would jump on him and wrestle him to the ground with his own men. And union business agents appeared, anonymous, they would never tell their names, who led the group trying to create a wall to force us out, trying to make it so no one would touch us. I thought I was not touched. I saw some pictures later. Apparently I was, and somebody must have flicked my neck, and there was a little cut, but it bled in such a way that it looked like I'd really been hurt, and people became hysterical. And out of that non-issue, a great issue arose of violence of the white workers. The police would not do anything. They would not come in the group. We were about 2.5 times deeper into it than past the end of this group. They would not cross this imaginary line. When we were finally thrown back to here, they moved back and then asked us if we would leave. But they were really, really inept, and they made no arrests. Now, there are pictures of the guy who grabbed me and the whole thing. You know, I've never made any complaint. I'm just trying to set up the obvious thing that you know about, of the difference of previous instances and how the police act when they're uncertain and when they like one side or another. The next day, the police were there first and opened a line. In both days, the construction workers came down to the Civic Square. The first day, the iron workers climbed the Picasso and the flagpoles, 8 stories. They just ran up the flagpoles. And two of them stood on the eyebrows of the Picasso and slid down to the nostrils and stood there. And it was really wild. They pushed women into the building, into the glass windows. They knocked people over benches. They ripped signs out of the women's hands and shoved them, swore at them, spit on them. No arrests. Now the police did do a great job. There were no riots, but there were no instances. If you compare them to any other traditional grape strike, certainly the convention bit is over dramatized for this purpose. But any simple thing where someone is always arrested. You may have seen a case where Jeff Fort was released. It was reported. Where supposedly he had called some police pigs and they charged him with mob action, a physical felony. Now, after those instances, and after the tears created on the Picasso by the heels of these steelwork guys who slid down, iron workers, there was no more mention of the youth gang issue. And so something constructive came out of it. The other thing that happened that was kind of constructive was the coalition, really isn't the greatest and largest body. But these guys, with their beer cans smashing against the cement or against the rails, the chains around the Picasso, screamed, "No coalition, no coalition." And it got bigger and bigger and bigger until it was bigger than they were. And they believe that it's the biggest organization there is. And they created it all by themselves out of their own hysteria. Well, that one has a very peculiar role for lawyers because at first, we were not allowed to speak at all. And certainly, our ideas in something in which lawyers' roles are traditionally hammered out, and where lawyers do almost all the work in negotiations for unions, we don't do any of it. What we really do is pass notes. And in caucuses, make points. But they're no easier to make than with the contract buyers' league. And generally, the negotiation is for ultimates. There aren't gives and takes. And now that's happening on both sides. And it takes a whole new set of attitudes and skills. When the coalition made a comment to the newspapers when they rejected a joint agreement which was drafted by the lawyers for the three sides, I was one of the three lawyers, and which was signed by the unions and builders, the coalition, through Vivian, came out and said, the lawyers didn't include everything. Now that was a severe criticism of me. I heard that at the University of Chicago, where I go sometimes, that there was a debate by some professors saying, well, they never would have let that happen to them. They would have gotten all 31 of the organizations to sign that paper and to authorize it first. That's terrific, but it never would have happened. And what that really means is that they see their role as one of protection. And what I'm trying to suggest is it's one of serving the client and finding a way to do it. And it hasn't hurt me very much to have that said. The funnier one was when the Chicago Today paper saved a great deal of time in interviewing by quoting me one day and saying that I no longer represented the coalition, and they didn't even bother to ask me about it, and they used quote marks. And that caused another whole relationship question. But none of those things have stopped the interest or improved the relationship. It just goes on, and we sometimes are asked questions, we sometimes are in the meetings. Most of the times they happen in my office, but in a different room. And we then serve the function of serving coffee rather than serving as counsel. I don't know what they're going to evolve out of it. It's a great example of someone having a desire to do their own thing, and we think we've got something to help them with and aren't going to impose it, but it's always available. But I'm not sure we have all the skills to handle it. And that's ongoing and kind of special. I'll jump to one other thing, and then maybe we should change sort of style. We found a scheme in Chicago where it was worked the most. It's an Illinois scheme, where if you fail to pay your real estate taxes for more than 2 years, your land could be sold for the back taxes to someone. Back taxes for a year or two are probably 5% of the value of the house. And if you don't redeem those taxes by paying up to 48% interest to the stranger who's bought your land, he gets the land. We have a pretty dramatic case of someone named Sacadlo who underpaid by mistake $26.24 and lost a $14,000 house. Underlying all of this were the incredible excesses of power, where the sheriff knew about the cases, would go out and throw people in the street, and the guy who held the deed would then negotiate with him to rent or sell it back in the rain or the snow. And mostly the cases came up with widows whose houses had been fully paid for, because if there were financial institutions in the picture, they would protect their investment and pay the taxes. It turned out that a very fancy law firm, and we talked to Nader before this started, he said there will be a very fancy law firm, and then there will be this and that, and all of them just came off. The guy's clairvoyant, I think. Not always accurate in some things, but it's really something special. And he predicted this, vain. A very fancy law firm bought the taxes. If they were not redeemed at the final hour, they sold to a lawyer named Alan Blair, who wanted land. And Ryko in Chicago did these two great articles showing the excesses and the problems, and choosing two very sympathetic cases of people who were simple-minded. One lady thought that her house had been given to her by God to use as a shrine, and another guy got his notice and he could tell you where he put it. He's been sort of simple since he's 13, and he saves papers, like newspapers and other papers, and he didn't do anything with it. But his penalty was to lose his whole house. That didn't affect the fact that the guy who was really wholesaling this practice was chairman of the Ethics Committee of the Chicago Bar Association. And the Bar Association said he was just enforcing the law. I appreciate your sympathy here, but there's a twist at the end that's unfortunate, that turns the other way. Blair went on quite cavalierly until we hit a case where he sold a house to a fellow named Rufus Thomas for $15,000, which was its market price, that he had picked up for $1,500, however, under this law, and didn't tell Thomas about the building code violations. And then when Thomas was sued, and Thomas bought on contract, so he didn't own anything, he didn't tell Thomas that it was he, Blair, who was liable for those violations. And then he volunteered to defend Thomas in the building code violations. And when he lost, and Thomas was fined $2,000 and had become a pauper by this time, and was to go to jail at $5 a day, Blair terminated the contract and wanted the land back. And he couldn't understand what was wrong with that. And we took that over and got the fine off, and Blair pleaded guilty to it finally. And the Bar Association started an investigation. I doubt if it'll go very far. And Thomas, unfortunately, we can't pursue the case. It's being settled because it's such a good deal now. We can't push the fraud aspect. It might lead to disbarment. Unfortunately, we don't own the issue, and I say it because that's really how I feel. Thomas has a right to his house, and he can now get it for less than half price. Obviously, that price is a function of the strength of our fraud allegations. And that's a hard position to be in as a lawyer, and a normal one in this kind of business. A week ago yesterday, the Supreme Court of the United States, to my so far greatest disappointment in practicing, upheld the statute. We have an opportunity for rehearing, but that's just not admitting that you've lost, I think, in the circumstance. Only Justice Douglas would have reviewed the case. And the lower court, where we got one of these three-judge courts, found that the statute was harsh. It created windfalls and all the kinds of words that you find in opinions that say that a statute is unconstitutional. But they said that it was a matter for the legislature. Now, I think we did a good job. It's possible that someone could have done it better. Or it might simply be that the court's not ready, or that we're wrong. It's a frustration, and maybe I'm sour grapesing it. But I think that you have to know, as well as the anecdotes and the interesting parts, that there's a heavy burden kind of practice. We expected to save those houses and expected to get the house back for Mr. Balthazar, who'd paid for it on contract and had paid for it 100% before he got sick and didn't pay his taxes. And he didn't get a sale of his land to pay the part that was in default. And then the surplus to himself, as happens in every other instance that you can find, he lost it all. And that's, in that instance, the law. The last two things I'd like to mention in a more general sense are some of the forums that we've used, and they come up through a pollution campaign. After talking to Nader once, where he said, don't call it pollution, call it violence, we tried to improve on that and created the Campaign Against Environmental Violence. And I'm terribly sorry I didn't bring an ad along. I'll send one, and maybe if you have another meeting, you can just pass it around, because some of you may have seen it. In October, on a Tuesday, annually, there's Cleaner Air Week. Well, the irony this year, or the irony in the air, perhaps, got too thick, and we decided to do something about it. Joe Karaganis was a very inventive and very industrious guy who had done a study and had a full section of the Sun-Times only a couple of months before devoted to the study of how judges are picked in Chicago, showed that it's so simple and so clear. No judge in Chicago is selected by quality. All judges in Chicago are selected by political clout. And that's not very novel, but when you put hundreds of them together, all the federal, all the state, all the lower, all the others, it gets more dramatic and will probably have no effect. But he did that, and he did it on his own, and that was published. And the next thing he did was he started to study public officials. And he found that the Air Pollution Control Board was made up of polluters. The mayor later said, well, what do you expect? They know more about it. Some unimaginative reporter said, "But why not put a card on the crime commission?" But he's probably pretty good at that. I don't know. But so Joe put the information together on the Air Pollution Control Board, persons who serve, and a genius that we've run into named John Baer, an extraordinarily creative man, wrote an ad for us, a full-page ad. Earlier in the summer, Joe had run an ad under an organization called the Hyde Park Kenwood Community Conference. This noise is a kind of environmental violence. It's gone away. The ad there said, Commonwealth Edison is injurious to your health. And no one had ever run an ad like that. The lawyers for the newspaper said, you can't run it. And Joe asked, why? Well, they tried to talk about libel. And he said, what you're really telling me is that you represent Commonwealth Edison and the newspaper. How are you going to resolve your conflict of interest? And magically, within a half an hour, both the paper and the lawyers agreed that the ad would be run. When the next ad came out, and John Baer's genius was that there's a light touch to it. It's the first kind of cause thing that I know about that's funny. It starts out with Happy Cleaner Air Week, Mayor Daley. I even saw a church following that week where the sermon was Happy Cleaner Air Week, Mayor Daley. And it talked about what the people were like. And the last one, the only one I'll try to quote because I'd blow it on the others. The last member was Arthur Schoenstatt, a retired, elderly millionaire. And what Baer did to that, I mean, that's really hard to write copy on. He said, wouldn't it be nice if he wasn't a retired, elderly millionaire? And it just had this light touch. And at the end, when everyone was unqualified or had a conflict of interest, Baer wrote, does this gripe you? Us too. Send us a dollar. Well, we've got thousands of letters and way over $1,000, and the ad, it's very unusual for an ad to pay for itself at a dollar. And so we're going to start new ones. And now the black balloon bit, and that this is going to grow. And it's just amazing to walk down the street and to feel kind of nice for a change when people say, that was the best damn thing that's happened for a long time. And if Baer can continue his genius and we can find the material, we're going to keep that up and keep up these petitions and that kind of a forum. But I'd like to tell you lastly about that ad. We presented it to the Sun-Times and told it would be printed. Then a very high official called me and said, you'd have to sign it. And I said, fine, we'll sign it. He was disappointed. And then he said, if you run this ad, we can't do what we were going to do on this Cleaner Air Week. We were going to write an editorial. And if you run this ad, we can't run the editorial. I said, gee, why not? Well, it would look like, you're buying or something. I said, I think I can beat you on that. You've run a lot of editorials on ads. Well, this one is personal. I said, it can't be very personal. You're going to print it. I said, I think I can beat you still. What do you want? And he said, well, what we were thinking is, if you don't run the ad, we'll cover this. You do it as a news release, and we'll cover it heavily. I didn't know that I could decide what would be covered heavily. And then the next day, we'll run an editorial. I said, gee, that was nice, but we'd like to run the ad. And then he said, well, if they don't run it, I said, I thought you said it would be run. And he said, well, he thinks so, but it has to go a little further. And then he said, if we don't run it, I hope you'll write to Mr. Field. I said, no, I wouldn't write to Mr. Field. We would sue Mr. Field. And I said, you ought to be on our side. And he said that he was. And about an hour later, we got a call that it was going. And they used awful print at the bottom of the ad. Maybe that was to get even with us. About the campaign against environmental violence. But it went out. And instead of on Tuesday, on Wednesday, they ran the editorial. So maybe there's some hope. At that point, why don't we change style?
All right, fine. Thank you very much, Marshall. Let's open the floor. Perhaps we ought to give priority first to the panel, but not for too long, and then open the floor generally to questions that you may have for either the panel or our speaker. Gentlemen on the panel, do either of you
have... I'd like to say just one thing.
Larry?
Just one thing to add for those of you who are now in Champaign and think that this stuff isn't close to home. It happens in big cities like Chicago, and it doesn't happen here. One, if you'll watch the legal notices in the Courier and the News Gazette, you'll see that Interstate Bond, which I believe is Alan Blair's...
It's the same company. It's the fancy
corporation. Is buying up property in Champaign County very regularly. They appear, I'd say, two or three notices a month. Also, one of the things on the effect of changing the forcible entry and detainer statute, what that would do, not only would help contract buyers, which in Champaign there are a lot of, for the same reasons that there are in Chicago. There are many contract buyers, most of your poorer people, if they own homes, and in Champaign you'll find that there are more homeowners among the poor than in a bigger city like Chicago, have all bought in by contracts, and a lot of them have not yet paid off on their contracts and are often subject to losing their property. Further, a change in the forcible entry statute would mean that, those of you students, this may strike very close to home. Very likely, if the housing that you were living in was substandard, contrary to the way the law is, you could use that as defense for non-payment of rent, or at least for getting the rent down to a reasonable amount for what you're getting. And it would do away with a lot of the inflated rents that are being charged for very poor housing in Champaign. So all these things that Mr. Patner has talked about strike very close to home right here in Champaign.
Yeah. I don't find anything that Mr. Patner says or anything that Mr. Nader says as being particularly overwhelming with regard to some of the injustice or justice that really affects people. About 10 minutes ago, when the siren went by here, that sort of struck home with me because I was thinking about some brothers that are being arrested tonight, and about 15 more that are in jail tonight, and about some of the other atrocities that take place every day, and some of my own experiences. And I know that I can care less whether or not that action that Jeremy Block is pushing is successful, simply because it does not affect what I call the truly affected people. I think it's what I call creative law, and creative law moves from the talented issue hunting constitutional lawyer to the defendant or the class of people who are represented in a class action who happen to be available. And that creative type law never hits at the basic cancer in society, which is what causes 50 people or more to be arrested in Champaign County or in any black community on petty charges every weekend. So therefore, I'm just not excited about presentation or any of the issues discussed.
Howard, do you have any?
I was struck by being a newspaper man by the role of the press in these kinds of issues, Marshall. On the one hand, implicit throughout your presentation was a very intimate relationship with a large number of newspaper reporters at a certain working level. On the other hand, especially in your last anecdotes about the ad, the sense of higher up, a resistance, and I put my observation in the form of a question. What do you expect to get out of the press, and do you trust the people you work with?
Well, what we'd like to get out of the press is to let the public know whether it's about what you've complained about or what I've tried to deal with, which some of which might be basic and relevant to what you have and some of which may not be. But in the tax deed case, we had one of the best examples of law reporting. We spent a great number of hours answering questions for reporters, most of whom had never been exposed to the kinds of what we call niceties, which are not really niceties. They're incredibly complex results of involutions of all kinds of things in the tax deed statute. But the reporting was absolutely pristine, and it was clear, and people understood the nature of this kind of proceeding. And our loss, I think, in a way, was more severe because, as it's explained, and as it's explained clearly, it seems to answer itself. What we were hoping to do, and what we are hoping to do in each instance, is to build on one thing that we hope we've established with the press. And what I tried to say in the CBL and the coalition, and maybe what you've brought up here, is the difficulty of establishing credibility in the black community. We've managed to establish credibility with the press. Now what happens is if something comes up, people call us to check. If we are asked about something and tell press people about it, it's accepted as being so. We've never overstated anything. We've never sought any publicity. When we got into a bail case, which I'd like to come to again to answer one thing there, there were two editorials, very thoughtful and clear on the problem. And if we can get up to the editorial level by careful, hard work, and if we can inform the public, if it's worth having democracy in some kind of a system, we hope to accomplish something to inform the public, to at least create a climate where it might be changed. In the pollution area, which is very popular now, and that's easy to do. Somehow it's caught on. In most areas, it's not easy to do, and it may be that we're simply deluding ourselves or complimenting ourselves by saying that the press respects what we said. As far as trusting goes, we've seldom gotten into any relationship with the press where we've done anything confidentially and asked them to hold it. It's happened about three times now out of, I don't know, 75 or 100. And in each of those instances, there's been no problem. The one I told you about, where it was reported that I no longer represented the coalition, was very tricky. And I obviously have a great deal of trouble now dealing with the reporter from that paper. It was the second time, I forgot to tell you, that he quoted me without an interview. Now, I think that the reporters generally, by their nature, have no friends, even though we're very friendly. If something really hits, it's their job to get it out and do something with it. So I've just not set up the possibility of the conflict to trust them and or to distrust them, because I don't tell them anything until it's well prepared. certainly will sometimes favor one guy, or there's been one guy who's followed the story and who's done a lot of investigative work, but will run on to things, as we did last summer with the students, constantly crisscrossing paths with reporters. And then we often will just give things away and step out of it if they're further along than we are. But I think that if we simply were very open-mouthed, we would have a serious problem. If you see the Chicago Journalism Review, the current issue has a long article on Charlie Swibel and some allegations of some very serious and very profitable double-dealing. That stuff all started in our office, and it's referred to a bit there. But the story got out much sooner than it should have. I have no criticism of the paper. It was our office. And I think that we could have gone much further. Just as Skolnick, in some of his latest antics, could have proved, I think, some of the allegations he made if he had just shut up for a while and done some more work. And we had more work to do on the Swibel story. Yes? Well, that's enough. That's more effective. Yeah. Well, let me try and see if I can phrase what you mean, and if I don't, then come back, please, before I try to answer it first. If you mean by view them objectively, I mean by that to try to take a case like the Balthazar tax case and see how many people it affects, and to see what we can get out of it for the effort that goes into it. And I try to evaluate what that means. I could tell you the number of people, I suppose, there is not so great. Maybe 700 a year in Chicago. I don't know how many in the state. Of people who lose their entire equity. Those are people that worked and paid. And that's a mixed group. I don't know how many are indigent. I know a couple have become indigent. That's how I got into this, because I then was with an OEO legal aid program in Chicago. That led me into learning so much about it. My objectivity and what I try to enforce is the same standard that the Legal Defense Fund of the NAACP does. They try to find a common problem and don't take the case that's sympathetic. They take the case that raises the issue so that if you win, you win for everybody. If what you mean the other way is to ignore individual cases and individual injustices, I often have to do that. Now, is that a fair restatement? Or what would you...
More or less, I was just wondering whether you, in your approach, can see what most people might consider
Well, I used that case because it was a massive effort by some volunteers, and we only kind of joined it. It's very frustrating, and I cannot be an apologist for a system that moves that slowly. I can understand it, and I can explain it, and say that were I on the other side, I'd pull the same antics. But I can't justify it. I don't know what answer, though, what alternatives I have to achieve more immediate results. What I'm now trying to do, and I is a collective I, but I have the responsibility, so I say it for the we and the group that we have, is to try to find some kind of pin to pull apart what's wrong. Now, I didn't mention, but maybe one that's closer to the immediate, and as you point out, atrocities, is fair. One instance where the frustration is great, but where the problem is immediate and where the common approach may be useful is something we did on bail. I did a report, and in this instance I gave it to one reporter early. He'd gotten onto it. And I'd been used to the slogan that the Stones run it, the Blackstone Rangers, the Stones run it. You see it written everywhere. And I wrote the report and said that in Chicago, the police run it. And I showed that the police set bail, that judges don't perform any function whatsoever, that bail is determined by what a policeman decides to charge a guy with.